Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this Sunday's and all the other Sundays these days, Limark Technical Net. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we come together here in front of our radios, and we chat, and we try to explain things and try to learn from each other and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. This is our Passover edition of the Technical Net, and I welcome you all. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual. If you would like to reach me via email to either ask a question through email or offer your services for technology in the news that you're well aware of and can explain it to the rest of us, or if you have a TechNet puzzle that you'd like to offer me, or if you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some NASA or space-related story, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, you can go direct to Paul. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. We offer a bunch of interesting links throughout the week. I cut and paste interesting articles and YouTube and such, and I post them on my link page, and they're available 24/7. If you have a case of insomnia in the middle of the night and you want something to read, and this is the list of what I think is interesting reading. You get to it by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the link, and it's up there 24/7. We have a chat room available. To get to it is relatively easy. Just type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and you'll land on our chat room. Sometimes it's very busy. Sometimes it's very quiet. We offer an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and I leave it on the rest of the week because a couple people asked me to. So if you want to know what's going on in Glen Oaks and you don't have a radio on you, but you do have Internet access, open up your browser, type technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll lead you to our audio stream. And, of course, I always like to remind people, Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It archives the Limark Technical Net for as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've moved out of the area or, unfortunately, become silent keys. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you what we got planned. Okay, surprisingly, not much new as far as I'm aware on the artificial intelligence front, so no report about that. Nothing new about delete, delete, delete from our friends over at the FCC, so we'll just have to hold our breath and hope for the best. So we're going to go straight to questions and topics and comments and such. I'll ask people to try and make the first few amateur radio related, since this is an amateur radio net, but we will endeavor to discuss any science or technology that anyone brings up here. So we'll take them in order, and we might adjust them depending upon the subject matter and the duration of the answer might be. But that's our plan. It hopefully should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul, WS2N, will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us all the way to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the game plan. If all the electronic equipment and human equipment keeps working and I don't get thrown off of All-Star, as I pretty much do 50% of the net, but I find myself back in it. Nevertheless, that's our plan for tonight, and I hope we have an interesting, stimulating series of conversations. So with that in mind, I'll give you all a call for to get on the list for tonight. Hit your push-to-talk, give us your first name, your call sign, and if you have a question or a comment, whether it's amateur radio-related or general science and technology, you know it by now, so let's hear.
And to the TV, amateur radio.
Wes and Rich recognize. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, hopefully as the night progresses, there'll be more check-ins with more questions or comments. Rich, you're up first. What do you got for us tonight?
Boy, and happy Passover. Happy Passover to everybody else. And good evening to everybody else. The question that I was going to ask is no longer relevant, but another question has popped up. I'm going to build myself a multi-band vertical, and it needs a transformer, of course, and an RF choke. I've seen pictures of RF chokes wound around a toroid wound around PVC pipe at all different number of turns. Every picture has a different number of turns. And I'd wonder, my first question, is there a correct amount of turns for an RF choke and multi-band RF choke? So that's my first question.
Okay. The short and less informative answer would be no. You can't pick up a textbook and say all chokes must be at least 7.5 turns around. It sort of depends upon a series of factors. You have to kind of understand what you're doing when you're making this particular type of an RF choke. What you're effectively doing is you're building an inductor. Inductance impedes current. It does not impede differential mode current because differential mode cancels out the effects of the impedance. But the thing that you want to get rid of is the common mode current, and that impedance is very effective. So you're looking for an inductor. And as we all learned when we took our FCC license test, inductance is a function of a few things. The number of turns, the size of the coil, and whether it's an air core coil or whether it has something like a ferrite in it that constricts magnetic fields and increases a given inductance for the same amount of turns of wire. So it's sort of important to kind of get an idea of what frequency you're working in, because obviously, inductive reactance is stronger as the frequency goes up. So you would probably need more turns to your coil if you were going to choke at 160 meters or 80 meters versus 6 meters or 2 meters. Usually, for ugly chokes or air core inductor chokes, usually people quote things like 5, 6, or 7 turns of the transmission line. Now, if you go searching a lot in different references, a lot of people are not really that thrilled with air core inductors because air core inductors have far less reactance and impede current than a inductor that has a ferrite core. That's why a lot of times you'll see people take a toroid, a ferrite material, take their coaxial cable and loop it around three, four, five times and have a much higher inductance and therefore a much higher impedance. You could never have too much impedance. You don't want to kind of coil it all over the place, you'll start to have resonant problems. But for all intents and purposes, if you're thinking to yourself, maybe I should put one more loop in, you probably can't go wrong. So that's the short version of that answer. I hope that's suitable. If there's any questions about it, Rich, feel free to ask me.
Well, this is multiband, so it's not one frequency. So I guess more turns is better for multiband, because if you want to take in 80 through 10, if you're winding it for 80, 10 would be included, by definition, I would think. So if you were going to wind a choke for 80, do you have an approximation of how many turns that would be?
Yeah, I mean, the number of coils you might want to use is mostly dependent on the lowest frequency you're planning to transmit on. Again, there are people out there, and you'll see all kinds of YouTubes all over the place that put about 5, 6, 7, 8 turns to an air core inductor. And yet you will hear people, especially people who sell ferrites, complain that that is not sufficient. Again, RF chokes are not binary devices. It's not an on or off type of thing. They produce a degree of attenuation, a number of decibels of loss of common mode. And the more inductance you have, the higher the attenuation you get. So if you put a ferrite core in it, you get a lot of attenuation. If you have an air core, you get some, but not a lot. It's enough for some people. It's not enough for other people. So if you were to look in textbooks and see what they seem to be coiling their air core inductors for RF chokes, again, it's usually, in my experience, has been anywhere from 5 to 8 turns of the coax cable.
This guy who designed the antenna, which I bought last night, a 25-foot telescoping whip. The guy who designed that, the antenna, used 14 turns around the toroid. And it's not so many turns that things are going to become resonant. And I don't know. Is more is better okay as long as you're not running into an amount of wire that's resonant on any of the frequencies that the antenna is going to be used for?
Well, it isn't strictly the fact that the length is the same as a radiating antenna, but there are resonances that develop on RF chokes. If you were to kind of hook up your choke to a VNA, especially a two-port VNA, you can't really do it with a one-port VNA, you could actually get a good sense of what a non-reflected, resonant, common mode signal is attenuated over frequency, and you'll discover that it's not a straight line. There are dips and curves and all kinds of things depending upon what ferrite mix you use, how many coils you have, and occasionally people, especially in balun designs, put in little capacitors to kind of get rid of some of the internal resonances. So there is fluctuation according to frequency. It is not a straight line, independent attenuation. You could always kind of hook up a two-port VNA and see exactly what's going on. Usually more is better, but there are extremes where that's not the case. Now, I'm a little confused because I thought you were talking about an air core RF choke, but then you said that around the toroid. So is the toroid a ferrite toroid or is it something else?
It's a MiX 31 ferrite toroid. Going around loops around a PVC is easier than let's say 14 turns around a toroid. Is one better than the other? Should you always stick to a ferrite, a ferrite mix 31 and turns around it, or it turns around a PVC just as effective?
No, the toroid is a much more effective design for an inductor. If you look at the equations that approximate the value of a given inductor's react, just coiling it is a kind of linear relationship. You know, if you make two coils, you can kind of approximately double the reactance by making it four coils. For a toroid, it's exponential. So, two coils is the square of one coil inductor. So, if you're just going to put, say, three loops of something, if you put three loops loops in an air core or any other thing, it'll triple it. You use three loops around toroid and approximately a cubit, to the power of three. So you get a lot more bang for your buck if you're using something like a toroid and looping your transmission line around the toroid.
Comment.
Yes, Leslie?
The ferrite toroid mix 31 is high permeability core used for suppressing common mode currents over the wide frequency of range. So it's commonly used for RFI and EMI attenuation and constructing common mode chokes on the cables and feed lines. Attraction.
Well, yeah, that's why Rich is going to use the Type 31. There are other ferrite mixes that are more appropriate if you're going to make a impedance transforming ballast, but for a simple HF frequency, because it's very important what frequency you're dealing with. Obviously, we're all dealing with the same HF band. If you were dealing with a completely different band, you may want to use a different mix because the frequency, the effect frequency has is different on the different mixes, but yeah, I would agree with you, and so would Rich, because that's the mixture of his ferrite.
Yeah, into HGM. Well, actually, there are two basic material groups, that one of them is having a permeability range from 20 to 850 mu, and if I remember correctly, nickel zinc, right, class. So that's mix 43, 52, 61. And another one is the high initial permeability is 850 mu, and usually manganese zinc, class 31, 73, and 75. So the zinc, the right cores, are used for one purpose, and the other one is for the other. So, it is not always that you can find something that is in the middle. It's another comment I have is talking about the vertical dipoles. Okay, it resonates fine, but look at the aperture of that of the dipole. So if you have a circular direction. A circular pattern of the dipole, then you can see just 360 degrees of a circle, and the signal that is coming to the receiver is coming from one side. So I'm not really very much fan of it. Back to you.
Okay, but a lot of people use it and they find it effective. You have to keep in mind that on a theoretical basis in free space, the directionality of a vertical antenna is what? Is 2.15. dipole. I think we're talking about dipoles. And as you bring it closer to Earth, these high, somewhat high, gains are kind of undermined, and everything gets kind of squishy and such. So you're not going to get the incredible directionality of a Yagi, per se, in any kind of vertical structure. So I wouldn't be unduly concerned. It's not going to ruin your day. And again, many people use it, and it works out fine by them.
Yeah, well, in terms of the reception or transmission, I would say the omnidirectional dipole vertically polarized is the worst antenna. Then the next one is Yagi. Sometimes people have built to have a bigger aperture, few Yagis in one direction. But there is a certain limitation. You mentioned that a few times already. And then the best one is waveguide. So, but waveguide has its limitations too, back to you.
As always, it sort of depends upon what you have going on. If your primary requirement is to squeeze together as much of your radiation pattern into a spotlight to reach a guy as far away as possible, then a directional antenna is a optimum choice. If you're operating a net, that's kind of the last thing that you want. You want an omnidirectional or a near omnidirectional antenna so that you're not going to be spending most of your time moving your antenna direction around to talk from guy A to guy B to guy C to guy D. I mean, that's one of the reasons why our repeater has an omnidirectional pattern, not a strong, simple, highly directional signal that a Yagi gives you. So it depends upon the requirements. There's no such thing as a best antenna. It's a best case antenna for your particular case, but there's no generic, this is the one antenna to rule them all thing going on.
I'm going to, just for the purpose of being devil's advocate, I'm going to take the other side of that and they say that try to defend Yagi. So a few weeks ago you mentioned collimator. It acts as an attenuator allowing properly polarized wave energy to enter the pipe. We're talking about the ducting or multi-ducting, right? So by that we may say that a ham radio operator who has a Yagi antenna could actually take advantage of it and direct the antenna to the duct. But if you have a multi-pipe, tropospheric pipe situation, then the cat has been fed. Don't listen to its BS cross-stitch pattern and using just a single pipe. So that would be some sort of collimator, and collimators are widely used in alpha, beta, k, as of its random radiation. So my understanding is that ham radio operators don't care about tropospheric ducting because it's so very much unstable. But if you don't have a Yagi antenna, you cannot even take attempt to use it. So I would say it is much better to have a Yagi antenna that you could direct horizontally, vertically, the way that you want it, to have a better reception of the ham radio operator from the other continent back here.
Yeah, this is, let me see if I have it, Roy. This, in effect, is a vertical N-fed half-wave. Again, 25-foot whip going into the transformer. And last night I bought a 56-to-1 transformer because he said it's more efficient than a 49-to-1. Don't know if that's true, but I'll find out. And that's going into the choke and then the feed line. So that's the whole antenna. Now, I'm a little confused about a counterpoise because I've been using now for 3 months a shortened NFED half-wave without a counterpoise. And he's saying you need a different counterpoise for each band, a different in length for each band. What are your thoughts on a counterpoise, Roy, for this type of antenna?
Well, theoretically, you shouldn't need much of a counterpoise. Sometimes it's simply a short length at the antenna feed point that suffices. Again, because you're dealing with a half wave, so you know theoretically it shouldn't require this guy that you seem to think knows anything is going to tell you that under all cases it has to be a core wavelength. So that's probably what he told you this particular antenna. But he also told everyone that somehow he knew the efficiency of his antennas, and some of them were 98%, and that's complete garbage. Number one, it's not that simple to figure out what the approximate efficiency is. And, you know, unless you work for jet propulsion labs, most antenna efficiencies are decent. Antenna efficiencies are somewhere between 70 and 50%. The fact that he is quoting 98% and such, and as far as I can discern, he derived these numbers from an orifice in his body.
The guy's a PhD in electrical engineering. He knows his stuff, Roy. He really does. He wasn't picking numbers out of the air. These were many years of testing. You have to watch the whole video to really get a sense of the provenance of his whole design. But, you know, I guess I'll put out a counterpoise and see if that helps everything or anything, and take it from there. I didn't want to buy a $70 RF choke when they're so easy to wind. So that's why I'm answering the questions about an RF choke. I've just seen windings all over the place, the number of windings all over the place. And anyway, the other question I had has slipped my mind. Anyway, the guy was saying he doesn't believe in antenna tuners. He only builds resonant antennas because again he feels that's most efficient. Oh, the other thing was, the counterpoises, he said, should be elevated, because if they're not elevated, the energy is just going into the ground, just warming up the ground, where if they are elevated, they're being used much more in a practical way. So, that's basically it. I will experiment and report back to the group. I hope that tuning for different bands by raising and lowering the telescoping whip won't be that too difficult. Back to you, Roy.
Comment?
Okay, Wes, you can have a comment in a second or two. I don't care what his credentials sort of were. I don't think he said he had a PhD. I think he said he had a degree in electrical engineering. Unfortunately, I bumped into at least one or two guys with degrees of electrical engineering who were management for the last 50 years, and did nothing useful as electrical engineers. And so, you know, surprisingly, they didn't know what they were talking about. And this guy doesn't either. I'll give you one simple quote from good old Google. Antenna efficiency is measured in an anechoic chamber by feeding some power to the antenna pads and measuring the strength of the radiated electromagnetic field in the surrounding space. Also says a good antenna in general radiates 50 to 60% of the energy fed into it, not 98, and you can't measure energy efficiency with a VNA no matter how expensive the VNA. So the mere fact that he said things that made no sense make me question the whole thing. Just because you see a guy on YouTube, just because he went to an EE school 50 years ago, unfortunately, doesn't mean he's not slightly delusional. Please, you wanted to say something?
KF2ZZ, standing by. Yeah, yeah. And to exam. Totally agree with you. Dr. Roy, Elevated counterpoise. Unbelievable. I couldn't stop to laugh. Look, you have a body of the car. The body of the car acts as a counterpoise to your dipole. Try to elevate this body of the car. You can. So you have to find something that compensates that body of the car. So it's aperture. It's something that would compensate on it. The elevated counterpoise is a something that is chosen not because we want it, but because we have no other choice. Back to you.
Well, I mean, there's a point.
The car is elevated westward.
Yeah, but let me talk, Rich, because otherwise we're gonna have that quick key nonsense again this week. The point is that this is very old news. Everyone hopefully should know that if you have a ground standing vertical, the amount of radials, you want to call them counterpoise, you can call them counterpoise, but they're radials, increases a great deal in order to shield your antenna from coupling to the ground. So minimum of 36 radials for a ground-mounted vertical, and some people go 72, et cetera. It's diminishing return, but you need that in order to block a lot of the RF from getting soaked into the soil. The reason why a lot of antennas that we know and love only have three or four radials is because they're elevated above ground. Once you raise the vertical above a certain level, and it's not a binary either. It's not a one or a zero. It's as you raise it, you get less and less ground cutting. You need less and less radials, and you can get by with one. It'll have a directionality to it. Two will have a slightly less directionality. When you have three or more, it kind of makes for a more decent omnidirectional antenna. But again, this is 100 years old. This is not this guy, whoever the hell he was. Yeah, I mean, okay, he has three models, but for all intents and purposes, his three models of antennas that he's selling people is a whip-adjustable quarter wave, a whip-adjustable half wave, and a whip-adjustable Wyndham, an off-center. So, I mean, like I told you in the email, I have a stereo 5/8 wave adjustable whip antenna elevated above the ground. Does that mean I'm an inventor? No, it means I bought an antenna that was probably discovered and documented 100 years ago like this guy did. So, and it's not 98% efficiency. I am willing to bet any amount of money. It ain't 98% efficiency. His efficiency numbers are completely made up. He has no anechoic chamber. He's calculating it based on a VNA. Can't do that accurately.
F2CC requesting be recognized.
Yes, Brian.
Oh, hi, Roy. I just wanted to just tell you I'm here. I had one question when you're ready.
Okay, very good. We'll take you in line. Anyway, sorry for the diatribe, but I mean, again, there are people, you know, who like to buy a nice bridge. I got the Brooklyn Bridge barely been walked on. If anyone have any offers, feel free to email me. I don't know what to tell you, Rich. You're a trusting soul, and you accept credentials. And, you know, I know a lot of guys with great credentials who are worth nothing because they're delusional. So I don't know what to make. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with his designs because his designs trace back to 120 years ago. It's just nothing special. I'm sorry.
First of all, don't mislead the audience because he's not selling anything. He's not selling anything. He doesn't get a commission on any of the parts or whatever. So he's not selling anything. And I thought his designs were perfectly logical, and I've never seen them presented that way. I've just never seen it before, and I had really, really taken a deep dive into antennas, especially end-fed half-waves. So let me ask you this. What can be measured with a DNA besides SWR? If you're measuring an antenna with a DNA, what are the different types of measurements you can do?
DNA. No clue.
VNA's vector network analyzers measure impedances. They measure resistance, they measure reactance, and they measure complex impedances. They can, if you use an S1 and an S2 port, you can measure the attenuation of signals dependent upon frequency. But that's the only thing. You can infer radiation resistance, but you can't accurately know what it is. And radiation resistance is only part of efficiency. There's nothing particularly that the VNA could offer you to know the insertion loss of your entire antenna system, which determines the efficiency. It's not just what goes on at the transmission line. It's what goes on in the radiating element. And again, most antennas do not pass 98% of the energy that you put on your coax line. They simply don't. So immediately when you see something like, since it was 98%, there's something wrong.
Well, he was taking into account the specs on the transformers from 10 antennas and from Chameleon and from Palomar and my antennas. He's working off their numbers. So unless they're lying, and I've never read anything to suggest that Palomar is, and DX Engineering, those companies are lying about the specs. I've never seen anybody say what you're saying, that there's no way to measure efficiency. So how could he come up with a percentage of efficiency? But he did. I think, I don't know, did you watch the whole presentation?
I watched the whole terrible presentation. Once again, I'm sorry if your experiences are more limited than mine. There is a way to calculate efficiency. It requires anechoic chambers. It requires RF field strength meters, and it requires integration software. The military does it all the time. It costs them millions of dollars, and if they could have bought a $100 nano VNA and skipped the rest, I am sure someone would have told them that. It's not what's going on, and I don't think that the manufacturers told them anything. I think he hooked up a VNA to these balans and checked on the S1, S2 ports for the attenuation. and that's just the insertion loss of the balun. It's not the rest of the antenna system. The antenna system is not a balun and an antenna. It's the coax and between everything. It's everything in line with your transmitter. And once again, 98 is a really stupid efficiency number. It kind of speaks that the guy's got some marbles lost. Let me try and invoke electrical engineers out there. If I got any electrical engineers out there, do any of you know about an antenna design that has a 98% efficiency in action?
Thomas.
Okay, I just want to get the EE's comment if I have any of you out there. Oh, well, unfortunately, we don't. Maybe later on. Yes, Brian, what do you want to say?
If you have a vertical antenna with radials going into the soil, how does it radiate? Does it radiate vertically and horizontally through the ground?
Yeah, unfortunately, radials is kind of a black art, and there's a lot of not right information written up on radials. You will, if you search around for the material, they will. There are descriptions of ground-mounted verticals where they suggest that you try to put the radial below the soil. So, although it will probably work, I don't think it's a more effective means of decoupling the ground from your antenna, because that's the problem. You should be using the radial wires as a mirror reflector for the lost segment. You have a quarter wave in most cases. You have a quarter wave unipole that you theoretically, to work, you would kind of want to have a dipole. You would want to have two legs of it, but you only have one. So you're setting up the radials to act as a kind of a virtual mirror for the first leg of the dipole. So the second leg of the dipole is not real. It's a virtual mirror response. So as long as you have those conducting materials at the base of the vertical, you're somewhat shielding your RF, your antenna, from being coupled completely to the ground and bleeding off your power. So it's a matter of it's setting up a virtual phantom secondary unipole, and it's working sort of like a dipole would under those circumstances.
Now, in a let's say an off-center fed antenna, your coax from the transformer going to your shack is acting as a radiating element, correct?
It depends. If you don't properly common mode choke it, it will. Being off-center, you are changing its inherent impedance. The lowest impedance for a balanced antenna is at the center point. So if you have a dipole, center-fed dipole in space, which is kind of the purest form of a theoretical construct, there is an impedance of approximately 76 ohms at the feed point. As you bring that antenna out of free space into Earth ground, you get some grounding coming. The impedance drops somewhat. And as you adjust the angles of the dipoles, that also affects the center-fed impedance. But when you get off of the center and you move either to the right or to the left, it always goes up. The lowest impedance is at the center point. If you have something like an off-center, you'll have something instead of 50 ohms, you'll have, say, 200 ohms, which is why the common impedance transformation balun is a 4-to-1, and the problem is if it's not perfectly balanced, then you might have the antenna using your transmission line as an additional counter, a strong RF choke at the antenna feed point, It'll lock that common mode counterpoise type of phenomena. And it'll just have to deal with the amount of wire on both sides of your off-center dipole.
Thank you. Dick says a few times, nature likes balance with you.
Yeah, well, nature likes a lot of things, and you can compromise with it, but you can't cheat it. In the end, it figures a way.
Roy, there's a guy named Jim Brown, another guy, not the guy who made the presentation. He's K9YC. K9YC. He wrote a publication called The Ham's Guide to RFI, Ferrites, Balance, and Audio Interfacing. And let me just see if I have it. Okay, he also, let me just see, he wrote, I think it was a book, or it may just be a paper on, I don't know, but he has measured data for HF ferrite chokes. This data was measured by a ham colleague using a well-calibrated HP instrumentation and was published both in my AES paper, see below, and in various tutorials. Here all the plots are rescaled to 1 to 100 megahertz on the frequency axis and 10 to 1,000 ohms on the resistance impedance axis. Anyway, I'm just trying to look for his other... He has a lot of papers... Power and Grounding for Audio and Audio-Video Systems, a white paper for the real world, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, if you guys are interested, and if you're needing to deal with ferrites and balance and RF chokes, just Google K9YC, and there'll be a wealth of information there. Whether he's a charlatan or determined. Back to you, Roy.
We're talking about two separate people. So your attitude is because I think one guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I guess you think that I think that no one knows what they're talking about. You can measure ferrites. I measured ferrites last Saturday in a group. I gave a discussion on nano VNAs. You know, I mean, that's doable. This guy, I'm sure you're not going to find this guy writing down that he has a 98% efficient antenna anywhere because that's nonsense. So, I mean, don't set up any kind of, scarecrows or something. I have nothing against this guy. I don't know this guy very well, but it sounds like he's a legitimate guy. It's just your guy, it doesn't sound like. You know, I mean, you might be doing right things, again, because these designs are inherently 100 years old, but his explanations are seemingly very self-serving. He seems to be very taken with himself, and I am not particularly taken with him. I watched the whole damn thing. I wasted an hour of my life, and at key points, he was telling people that, you know, the Earth is round, and his audience was going, oh, my, really? Really? I had no clue. So a lot of them are taking naps, apparently, and it just, you know, not every flim-flam guy impresses me. That's all that it's to. And if you're going to say something foolish, then I'm going to think you're foolish. That's just the way I think. So, I mean, don't paint me with this weird wide brush about this other guy that I know nothing about, but I don't. You haven't told me anything to have me warrant suspicion, whereas this other guy, every other thing he said was a little fishy.
Boy, he was just, first of all, his antenna designs, he had two designs and two variations each of the designs. You have no argument with those, right? I mean, like you say, they're 100 years old, but I've never seen anybody put them together like this. Aren't you only disputing his K9 calculations on efficiency.
Yes, that's the one that I have problems with. Again, I don't have any problem with the antenna design because they've been working for over 100 years. I'm a little bit weirded out by him sort of printing it like it was his own. I mean, Betty came up with this brilliant idea of inventing parasitic elements and reinventing the damn Yagi. So, I mean, this guy seems to reinvent a lot of things. So that concerns me a little bit. Again, the underlying theory of the antennas that he presents are fine, although I dispute his efficiency levels dramatically. That's all. But to me, that's important. To tell people foolish things like a 98% efficient antenna is, you know, you could hook up together. It doesn't exist. Again, it just doesn't. And if he thinks it does, I don't know how his brain is working these days.
He also had efficiencies that were very low, and he explained those too. So I don't know. It may have been just relative to the whole spectrum of efficiencies on, you know, different using different components for antennas like this. He also discussed the off-center dipole. And I don't know. We'll see. But I wish some of the double E's that show up here once in a while could take a look at it and get a second opinion. You should always get a second opinion. But also this K9YC looks very interesting and knowledgeable. Anyway, that's about it for me. 73, everybody. Again, happy Passover, and I'll be listening.
Comment.
Yes, Brian.
Two things. First of all, I looked up that one that I think the other gentleman, I forgot his name, I'm sorry, that was mentioning about that K9YC or something like that. He owns an audio company, I think. That's number one. Number two, I do agree with Roy on, in many professions, people who have a designation such as PhD, or it could be an MD, or it could be a DDS, or it could be a PSYD. There's people who know their stuff, and then there's people who really don't know their stuff. On the basic level, they might, but on other things, to think out of the box, okay, they may not.
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Do you see a difference between book knowledge as opposed to creative knowledge? Knowledge that is in the present moment, something that's happening right now. The knowledge in the book is from the past. It exists in the book, and it has value more or less than present moment creative knowledge, you know?
Yeah, I think that's neither here nor there. I mean, there are things that make sense and there are things that just don't make sense. And, you know, if you tell me that in practice you went someplace and built an over-unity generator that plugs into itself and is an endless supply of power, just because you say it doesn't necessarily mean that I believe you. And if I default to 150 years of conservation of energy laws, and you kind of say, well, that's an old fogey thing, because those conservation of energy laws were written 150 years ago, and this is today. You know, it's immaterial. I don't really care what the nature, what the inherent source of the information. I care for the results that make sense to me and are consistent with my understanding of the way that the universe runs. So I hope you can appreciate that. You can't creatively break the laws of physics for the most part, unless they're not true laws of physics. So, you know, creativity is wonderful, but there are some inherent laws of nature that are inviolate, and you could be the greatest poet in the world and have the greatest imagination, but you can't make things via the laws of physics.
But what I'm going to do for next week is I'm going to see exactly how he came up with his efficiency ratings, whether they be the low ones or the high ones, and hopefully maybe some of the double E's will be on next week and see where the, you know, you may be right, Roy. I don't know. You may be 100% right. You may be 100% wrong. I just want to break down how he came to his conclusions and see where we go with that next week. All right, I'm done. W2BZ, clear.
Okay, very good, Rich. Good luck with the antenna. I have nothing particularly against the antenna design. Like I said, it's not particularly that special as far as I can see. In all cases, if you can elevate your vertical antenna above ground, that is a much easier to build device. You do not have to use 72 radio going out, and different people have their own favorite number of radials and length of radials, some uniform, some vary according to the multiband nature. And the study that this guy cited, I read it as well. It was in QEX, so those published articles are legitimate things, and I have nothing bad to say about them. Just him. That's all. Anyway, maybe we'll revisit this again. Maybe not. We'll see. I wish you luck with always, Rich. I always wish you the best. So I wish you the best with this, and I don't see any particular problem. It'll be an effective antenna. You know, we can quibble with the efficiency numbers if you want, but, as long as it works. Wes, I think Brian has one question. Would it be okay to kind of push him at the top of the list for the benefit of tonight?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Brian, you're up.
Okay. Well, what I wanted to say is that if you have a vertical antenna with radials going into the ground, don't the radials conduct RF?
They do, but ground is not a particularly, it's not a consistent environment also. So, I've used antenna selection software, which this guy has used. And it's unfortunately a case of garbage in, garbage out. If you're so inclined, you can get all kinds of weird results just based upon the decisions that you make to include aspects in the design that are kind of spurious. So one of the things that antenna simulators have is an earth-ground oscillation. And they have, I think, about five different characteristics ranging from salt water drenched sand, like you're right next to the beach, to granite. But, I mean, that's not a very granular set of choices. In order to be more realistic in your antenna modeling, a lot of times you need a lot more granularity with the characteristics of ground. So if your ground is basically granite, the amount of conduction that's going to take place right below the soil is not going to be a heck of a lot. So you can still use it as if it was right on top of the soil. And that's pretty much kind of what happened. I mean, if you happen to be doing it next to the ocean, then you're going to have some problems.
Okay, but if you have, let's say, some, if you just have general soil, let's say just regular, whatever, Long Island soil. I remember a long time ago somebody told me that Long Island soil is the worst conductivity. The question is that if all that flows through the soil, how far does it conduct?
Again, it sort of depends on the conductivity of the soil. If it's not very conductive, then it will dissipate and turn to heat long before, you know, it gets very far.